Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, Title IX, the landmark legislation on women's equality in higher education, was passed to equalize funding between men's and women's athletics. What has it achieved? And where does it fall short? Doug Becker explores.
I'm Doug Becker. March is Women's History Month. March is also when college athletics focuses its attention on its basketball. With tournaments well known as March Madness, these lead to the championships being awarded for both the men's and women's programs. And this year, a growing trend is quite clear. The women's tournament is more compelling, more exciting, and quite frankly, more popular than the men's tournament. So how did the growth of women's athletics develop historically? Landmark legislation on women's equality across universities called Title IX set the stage for the transformation. So on today's show, we'll track the history of Title IX, the demands for equality across athletics programs as a part of the requirements broadly in Title IX for gender equality and equity have compelled a reconceptualization of men's and women's sports. But how effective has Title IX been? What is some of the legal history behind the implementation of Title IX? What's its status decades after the legislation? And what does the advancement of women's athletics in revenue-generating sports like basketball mean for gender equity across all sports and generally gender equity across the university? Our panel today is Lisa Kaplowitz. She's an associate professor of professional practice in the finance and economics department at Rutgers Business School, and also the co-founder and executive director of the Rutgers Center for Women in Business. She's the author of an opinion article, Title IX, Increased Opportunities for Women's Athletes, But There's Still Work to Do, and Thought Leadership, How Men Can Advance Gender Equity at Work. Bonnie Morris is a lecturer in the Department of History at the University of California, Berkeley. She's the author of The Feminist Revolution, Women's History for Beginners, and What's the Score? 25 Years of Teaching Women's Sports History. And joining us a bit later, Nancy Hogshead Maker. She's on the faculty at Rutgers New Brunswick Global Business and Sports MS program. She is CEO and founder of Champion Women and won 3 gold medals and 1 silver medal at the 1984 Olympics. She's the co-author of Equal Play, Title IX and Social Change with Andrew Zimbalis, and the author of Pregnant and Parenting Student Athletes, Resource and Model Policies. Thank you all very, very much for joining us. And Bonnie Morris, I'll direct the first question to you. You are a historian. What was the motivation for Title IX? Where did it come from? And what was it trying to accomplish?
Well, thank you. It's a pleasure to be here and to be a historian in this exciting area. Title IX is part of the Education Act of 1972. It was signed into law by President Nixon on June 23rd, 1972. It evolved not at all as a, quote, sports law. It evolved out of concerns about discrimination against women in academia. And among the many people who worked on it were Bernice Sandler and Congresswoman Patsy Mink, and a number of male allies as well, Birch Bive, Indiana. The idea was that women were experiencing low promotions, different pay, sex-based discrimination in terms of why they weren't getting promotion and tenure. Many universities were still closed to women. Some admitted women on a quota system or kept them out of specific majors. There were very different rules for campus living. So women were paying the same tuition and not getting the same opportunities. And in the high schools, there were all kinds of egregious examples of girls being made to take home ec and guys taking shop or auto repair and being trained for union jobs with better pay. Initially, Title IX's language is simply, any university that or any educational institution that receives federal funding may not discriminate in any activity or event. And this means, right from the beginning, schools that choose not to receive federal funding don't have to comply. Also, Title IX only applies to educational institutes. It is not a workplace or workforce law, so you have equal rights till you graduate. As soon as it was passed, though, it was apparent to everyone in PE that that was the biggest area of discrimination against women in terms of funding. 99% of all sports budgets went to men and boys, leaving 1% for women. And there was immediate panic. And essentially, schools were given until as late as 1978 to come into compliance. And it's important to look ahead and note that women weren't brought into the NCAA until 1982, with the NCAA kicking and screaming. So the discussion about how sports would be adjusted to be equal for women and girls took an entire decade, and compliance lagged really for the first 25 years or more. That's just a little bit of the history, but I'll pause there.
And Lisa Kaplowitz, I think, you know, part of what Bonnie was suggesting, and this probably comes as no surprise, is it's one thing for Congress to pass legislation. It's another to see actual compliance. And so in what ways were the universities pushing back against congressional demands for equality, for gender equity?
The law was pretty simple. It had three parts to it. The first part said, hey, you have to have equal representation of men and women that mirrors the representation of that academic institution. You know what? You can still be in compliance with the law, but if you don't, but you have to show that at least you're meeting the interests and abilities of that underrepresented sex. And you know what? If you're not doing that, but you are showing that you are expanding the programming for that underrepresented sex, you still be in compliance. So there were so many ways that they could get there, yet they still weren't getting there. I want to start out with the positive, though, because I always love starting out with the positive. Before Title IX, only 15% of college athletes were women. Today, 44% of the opportunities to play sports go to women. Since Title IX, 3 million more high school girls play sports, and 200,000 more college women have the opportunity to play sports every year. That's the positive. Mm-hmm. But it doesn't mean that we're eating pie and all of a sudden men didn't get these opportunities and they were getting taken away from them. Because 26% more high school boys and 62% more college men are participating in sports. And all of this is based on studies by the Women's Sports Foundation. And so, you know, it is really positive. And I know we're going to talk about this later, because as the NCAA says, most of us go pro in something other than sports. And there are so many lessons that we learn from sports that, you know, really benefit everybody, especially women when they transition out of sports. But even though there's been progress, one study showed over 80% of institutions still haven't reached Title IX compliance so many years later, over 50 years later.
Yes, Bonnie, you wanted to respond?
I would add that one of the reasons that's a complication in all of this is many schools, of course, give the lion's share of their budget to football, and there just isn't a women's sport that's equivalent to football in terms of how many bodies, how much size. In terms of a facility, there's also the unquantifiable aspect that when a football team has a good season, alumni donate more to an institution, more students apply, the university feels branded. Until recently, there just hasn't been a women's sport that commanded that level of prestige, drew that number of, you know, audiences. And we still see men being given football scholarships in enormous numbers. And the argument is that football brings in more money, therefore deserves more money. So what we saw in the early years of Title IX was schools that did not want to touch a football budget scrambling to make room for women's sports dollars. And they did so, unfortunately, by cutting some, quote, minor men's sports, which are often Olympic sports like wrestling and diving and swimming and, yes, men's gymnastics. That also pits smaller bodied men against football and basketball players. So that's a whole other discussion, but it's important to bring it up.
No, and Bonnie, you know, I think there might be a research opportunity for us in there after the Caitlin Clark effect, because now I'm curious, mm-hmm. as you said that, I hadn't thought about it until now, but I wonder what that's doing for Iowa's applications, donations, et cetera. And I know we'll probably get to Caitlin Clark at some point, because there's no way we couldn't.
Yes, Bonnie.
Please go ahead.
It's very much a financial argument. Very quickly, it flips to that. And of course, what I'm fond of saying is how interesting that we want women to be fit and trim, and we require girls as well as boys to take PE. You don't get out of gym because you're a girl. It's only when you start to be good enough to play pro and earn money that suddenly the door slams shut. So we are in the United States heavily invested in developing physical skills in young girls and requiring them, you know, to join teams in schools. But we're ambivalent about older girls and women in public performance. And some of that is the legacy of modesty, the incredible pressure to look feminine while you're doing anything. You know, these things are linked. There's historically been, still in many cultures, a ban on women showing their arms and legs in public and women getting, you know, hot and sweaty in front of men who are not their relatives. So there's always going to be debates about uniforms and presentation and, you know, the women's uniform coming in pink, no matter what the team colors are for the school. So women have to deal not only with the budget issue, the femininity and sexuality issues, and then all of the other very intrusive questioning about why should we invest in you because your peak athletic years are also your childbearing years, and aren't you just going to, you know, get pregnant and take time out and then return, you know, an injured athlete, as it were. So there's also people who see the woman's own body as almost being a strike against her with its cycles and changes and maternity. All of this is very much part of, as Lisa mentioned, the excellent studies that the Women's Sports Foundation has done and compiled. And a lot of their work also looks at where colleges have thrown money at sports like crew for women, which on paper eats up a lot of dollars and looks like a great budget choice, but historically has not recruited women of color or, you know, women from inner cities. So we have to look at class and race as well as gender in terms of who's getting what opportunity and who's historically had opportunities. And it rolls over into the problem of soccer being a very sort of late American sport, but requiring a lot of green space. And by the time that became part of schools, it was sort of thrown at women, became identified as female, and limited to the affluent suburbs where more green space could be had. That's in complete contrast to soccer in the rest of the world, where it is poor and brown. So there's a lot of unusual aspects about American culture that define what we watch and what we fund and what kind of bodies we recruit.
Bonnie, I think that's so important. This is Lisa again. And your point on Title IX, and it really has benefited the white girl and the white woman, especially when we think to the younger girls as well. There aren't nearly as many opportunities for Black and Brown girls to play sports in middle school, in high school, especially in these Title I schools. I was on a nonprofit board called Power Play that empowers girls through sport. And, you know, really the work that those kinds of organizations do is so vital for these girls because, again, of all the benefits that they get once they hang up those uniforms.
No, absolutely. And you're listening to Scholar Circle. scholarcircle.org. I'm Doug Becker. In honor of Women's History Month, and also in honor of all of our attention being placed on college athletics, our topic today is Title IX, the impact on women's equity and women in sports. And our guests today are Lisa Kaplowitz of Rutgers University, Bonnie Morris of the University of California, Berkeley, and Nancy Hogshead-Maker of Rutgers University, as well as the CEO and founder of Champion Women. And Nancy, we've started out basically talking about the history of Title IX. What was the intention, of that, and how well that was accomplished? So I'll ask you the broad question there. How important has Title IX been at addressing these questions of equity in athletics, and in what ways has it fallen short?
Well, it's been the law on what girls and women are entitled to under Title IX is phenomenal. It is, courts repetitively say equal means equal. What women and girls actually get is another story. What's missing is there's just not enough enforcement. So Champion Women, the nonprofit that I run, we filed 101 complaints with the Department of Education that talked about how girls are missing out on opportunities to play, how they're not getting treated the same way, and scholarship dollars. Just in those 101 schools out of 2,000, girls are being denied $500 million just in those schools. Overall, women are missing out on $1.1 billion in athletic scholarships. So unfortunately, right now, the NCAA used to do it. They used to require, they had a Title IX component to being a member, and they backed out of that when Mark Emmert came on board in 2010. And now it's really up to the girls themselves and their families. And to your point, Lisa, about making sure that girls of color, that it's, you know, who ends up contacting Champion Women or a lawyer is usually very sophisticated parents, as opposed to, right, who needs me and Champion Women and a lawyer the most are people who come from inner city schools, you know, girls who come from just, you know, less resourced schools generally. I'm shocked that I think it's like number five on our list is Howard University. Some HBCUs are doing a terrible job with Title IX compliance. But again, getting back to what Lisa was saying about how important this is, it's like denying somebody math class, that what they're missing by not having a sports experience is lifelong better health. My age group, osteoporosis is a really big deal. The way that you prevent it is weight-bearing exercise during puberty. Kids that play sports, let me just take a one step back. When you're looking at education policy and you're looking at like, okay, what activities help a kid out predict what they would have accomplished anyway? And the one thing that does that, that other things that you might like, student government doesn't do it. Debate club doesn't do it. What does it is sports. It helps people out predict, right? It's a very good use of our public tax dollars for these long-term gains. We can measure Title IX. We can measure what it does for girls and women because there was a time before Title IX, then there's a time afterwards. We can't measure the same way with boys, that causation as opposed to correlation. But, you know, there's no reason to presume that it would be any different for boys. Mm-hmm. But yeah, no, it's a most athletic departments could literally double in size, both high school and college. And, you know, there would, you know, still be kids that want to play that aren't playing.
You know, these comments, you know, have me thinking. And Lisa, I'll first direct this to you because I know you've spent a great deal of time talking about, you know, the business and financial side of this. There seems to be a general tension just broadly about college athletics, about how much college athletics is really about making the university money versus a part of the, you know, the educational process, mind, body, and soul, and the ways that these are all interconnected. Has Title IX shifted that focus, you know, at all to say athletics really are about serving the interests of the students, not the interests of the boosters or the interest of the, you know, the development offices at universities to make money? Or is that, I mean, that tension certainly still seems to be there, right?
I'm going to say one thing and then I'm going to punt it to Bonnie probably here on that. I think we're going through a moment right now that doesn't have to do with Title IX, and there hasn't been enough research or data to see what the impact is going to be. But when we see the whole name, image, likeness, NIL, we've gone from student athletes to athlete students. And now there is not that same loyalty to your team or your coach because you're just going to go where you can get the biggest paycheck. And some women have really benefited from this NIL. You have Livy Dunn at LSU. You have Caitlin Clark. You have, you know, so many folks on the LSU women's basketball team as well. And so there are some that have benefited from it. But then I think that's changing the whole dynamics of women, of all college sports. And I don't have enough data to accurately talk about it. Nancy, maybe you do. But I'm curious to see what that says.
And Nancy, go ahead.
Yeah, it's not that I have data. It is that we just finished releasing a report that has to do with the Olympic movement. The Olympic movement is roughly twice the size of the high school and college market put together. So the Olympic and Paralympic movement is all club sports, so schools, sports that are not associated with a school. And one of the things that we said is that, you know, we over-romanticize this idea about an amateur athlete. And instead, there's no reason why athletes, if they can make money, to make money. You know, I competed. I was an Olympic swimmer. I won 3 gold medals in the 1984 Olympics. I wasn't allowed to make any money during that time. And what that means is that I could do it because my parents could pay for it. And so that it blocks out a huge group if you can't do that. So then second is the word amateur athlete or even student athlete, it tends to infantilize the athlete as that they're not, right? One of our recommendations is not to use the word amateur anymore and instead to say, you know, these are athletes, however, you know, wherever they are on the, you know, 6 and under, so all the way up to master swimmers. But, you know, like sort of Lisa was saying, that athletes don't have the same attachment to their school. I don't find that a problem at all. In the law, lawyers go to the law firm that will pay them the best. In academics, it's the same thing. People go where they can make the most money and that, you know, there's nothing wrong with that. Who it hurts is the power structure of the booster as an institution, right? The coaches and the athletic directors, they want athletes to be powerless, voiceless, to not be able to have a vote on how the money gets spent. And most of all, both in the school environment and in the Olympic and Paralympic environment, most of the new money that is being generated goes into the back pocket of a very small number of people. It is not going to the athlete. So in the Olympic movement, revenues have gone up like 50-fold in just the last 20 years. And athletes haven't, we stopped, athletes have been able to make money off their name, image, and likeness, right? This is what college athletes want to get. Right. So they've been doing this since 1992. And yet, you know, half of our Olympic team, which is only 800 athletes, but half of them live on couch surfing. Half of them, they get almost, right? So the money doesn't trickle down. It stays, the executives pay themselves handsomely. They think they are so important.
Yes, Lisa, you had a response?
Right. Nancy, I agree with you. I guess my challenge is and I know we're all faculty here, is I totally think that athletes should make money, but if you're going to school, I want you to come to my class. I want you to actually do the work.
Right. Could not agree more.
That's where my attention ends up going. And I know, Bonnie, you want to talk.
100%.
Yeah.
I think Doug brought up a few minutes ago, are we having a moment where, you know, women are suddenly doing so well? I would say you could look back into just, you know, the first generation of Title IX, we see women bringing home more gold than men by the 96 Olympics, if not earlier. And the tendency in the United States is everybody loves a winner. So in that concentrated period of time around the Olympics, everybody will be very impressed with and supportive of women athletes and then forget about them, you know, the rest of the year, with this small exception of Women's History Month, which nicely coincides with March Madness. The thing I wanted to point out is that because of Title IX making more athletic scholarships possible for girls, we start to see parents perhaps pushing a daughter to identify with a particular sports skill pretty early, knowing that that could lead to a path to college. And sometimes that goes into a slightly more mercenary direction with excited dad saying she's going to have her own shoe. And it gets tied in with material culture, which I might add is made by women and girls at much lower wages in faraway lands. And then that circles back to one of my favorite topics. Do we expect a higher level of morality from female athletes? Are we more critical when they want to be paid? Do we act shocked and clutch our pearls that women might actually want to make a dollar? Do we expect the women's game to be pure and clean and family entertainment at family prices so that our WNBA, you know, athletes earn less, so the game tickets are lower? And those are all connected. And historically, in, let's say, recent years, you'll see when men's teams or men's sports are having a bad season with negative headlines, crime, gambling, intimate violence, drugs, murder, whatever, journalists will look to the women's game and say that women play for the love of the game. Isn't that beautiful? They never get into trouble. And, you know, we have some statistics that college women tend to have higher grades, graduate on time more often, fewer, you know, behavior violations, whatever. But that puts a lot of pressure on women and girls to be angelic and pure. And it brings much harsher scrutiny if there's even the smallest normative freshman year, you know, bobble of behavior. I think that that's also part of this economic game, that turning to the women's game as family entertainment connects with low cost, connects with low pay. And I don't have an answer, because I understand Nancy's point, you know, that the right to earn a living and not couch surf is very much a part of this. But we're tense about women earning their own money because it's always implied that, oh, then you don't need to find a husband and get married if you bring in your own, you know, income. All of that is connected with our cultural anxiety about women being outstanding in fields that were once reserved for men.
When we come back, when some schools failed to implement Title IX for athletics, activists sued. What has been the result of these landmark cases? Stay with us. This is the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. The courts have been weighing in on schools' obligations to equality in sports. What have the Title IX court cases achieved? Doug Becker explores.
I'm Doug Becker. Our panel today is Lisa Kaplowitz, an associate finance professor in the economics department at Rutgers Business University and the co-founder and executive director of the Rutgers Center for Women in Business. Bonnie Morris is a lecturer in the Department of History at the University of California, Berkeley. And Nancy Hogshead-Maker is on the faculty at Rutgers New Brunswick Global Business and Sports MS program. She's the CEO and founder of Champion Women and won 3 gold medals and 1 silver medal at the 1984 Olympics. Thank you all very, very much for joining us. First of all, Bonnie, you know, I guess, you know, as the historian on the panel, what have been a couple of the real important landmark cases that, in essence, I mean, one of the narratives broadly about the NCAA is for all of the legislation that gets passed and all of the platitudes, the courts are really what frequently compel the NCAA to become compliant. So what have been some of those cases?
Well, I'll throw it to Lisa in a hot minute since she was an actual plaintiff. But in the 80s, the two most important turning points were Grove City College versus Bell in 1984, which turned back the clock. The challenge there was universities during the Reagan administration suggested that only departments that directly receive federal funding should have to be in compliance. So if, you know, the engineering school got federal funding, they would have to be in compliance with Title IX, but perhaps not basketball. And that allowed a stall for 4 years. And then that was overturned with the Civil Rights Restoration Act of 1988. And unfortunately, you can see there's this start and stop and start and stop. And universities could still be incredibly slow with compliance until they get a real challenge. And the big one we tend to draw a circle around is Brown University versus Cohen, featuring Lisa.
Absolutely, Lisa. Thanks, Bonnie. What can you describe that case?
That was a great transition. So Cohen versus Brown, I was a recruited athlete. I happened to be a gymnast. In the 90s, Title IX was mostly played out in athletics. And I was heavily recruited. I competed with most of the girls in the 92 and 96 games. And so back in the day, we had to put our confirmation card in the mail because there was no internet. And so the day before that card had to go in, I get a phone call that they cut my sport. College was my ticket out of poverty. We were on food stamps at the time. And I had no other pathway. So I ended up trusting the coach. She said, we'll figure out a way to make this work. Brown ended up cutting four sports. They cut women's gymnastics, women's volleyball, men's water polo, and men's golf. The two women's sports combined that they cut saved a whopping $62,000. A year. That was it. At the time, the university enrollment was almost 50-50 men and women. It was 49% women, 51% men, and only 37% of the athletic opportunities were provided to women. So based on the prongs I said before, Brown was not in compliance with Title IX prior, and they definitely weren't when they cut these sports. So it was the first case that was tried covering an entire athletic program, and they hadn't expanded the program in over a decade. And on top of that, the gymnastics team had won the Ivy League championships the year prior. So not only did they not have representation, they showed that they were capable. They showed that there were athletes like me that were interested and able. And they also showed that they were not expanding the programs. Brown's argument was that you can't dictate the budget and women just aren't interested in sports. Great argument, right? And they also said, well, we're discriminating less than other schools. So... Right. Great argument again. So as a result of that, last resort, because we tried to do other fundraisers, like embarrassingly do flips on the main green to try to raise money and bake sales and all of these other horrific things, we ended up suing the school. I was 17 years old at the time, so I had to have my mommy sign the paperwork because I wasn't even a legal adult. And found myself as one of the named plaintiffs. And so the case went on for about 7 years. About halfway through my college experience, we had a preliminary injunction, which means we were fully reinstated to varsity status. We were functioning as a club varsity team at the time. Part of the impact, the case ended up going all the way through the courts up to the Supreme Court of the United States. And the Supreme Court didn't grant it certiorari, which meant it upheld the decision of the lower courts, which every step of the way said, yep, Brown, you are discriminating, you are violating Title IX. And so that case ended up becoming a landmark case. And other universities looked at that case and said, hey, Brown wasn't in compliance. Why don't we try to do something to get in compliance? At the same time, there were a lot of schools that didn't do anything because we said before over 80% of schools are not in compliance. But the result of that case is what ended up for me personally spurring my passion to advocate for women, not only in athletics, but in life after sports. Because those skills, and I think, I can't remember if it was Nancy or Bonnie, you all alluded to it, those skills are so important in life after sports. ESPNW and EY did a study. 94% of women athletes played sports growing up, and over half of them, 94% of women in the C-suite, excuse me, played sports growing up, and over half played in college. Those skills are absolutely transferable.
If I can jump in for a second, if listeners are unfamiliar with some of this history, at the time that Title IX passed, many universities were still closed to women. Harvard, Cornell, Yale had an understanding for every, you know, two women admitted, three men were admitted. So women were competing against each other with higher standards for admission for fewer slots. So when the idea of proportionality was introduced, that schools should give athletic dollars proportionate to how many women were enrolled, it seemed like an easy thing to do because at the time that that compliance prong was introduced, women were maybe a third, you know, of schools if they were admitted at all. Nobody ever anticipated that because Title IX opened the door for fair enrollment and admissions, women are now something like 55 to 60% of undergraduate enrollment around the country. There is no co-ed school that gives 60% of its budget to women that I know of. And so when Lisa says, you know, here you had a school like Brown, by the early 90s is pretty much 50-50, but the, you know, female athletes are still at a third. You need to know the backstory of that. Nobody ever planned for women to be more than half of college campuses, but it's a great example that when you remove discrimination, look how well women do. And there's a lot of confusion, guilt, and reaction to that truth.
And Nancy, I want to give you a chance to respond as well, because I know the group Champion Women have been filing a number of complaints within the NCAA. Would you like to talk about a couple of those?
Sure. First of all, let me just say that when the Brown University case was going on, well, let me backtrack a little bit more than that. When Title IX was passed, I thought that women didn't compete in college because their bodies didn't get any better. I thought that, like, you know, they kind of peaked physically, and that's why they didn't keep training. When I was about a junior in high school, it was like somebody took a blowtorch to the whole country, and suddenly I pretty much could have gone anywhere that I wanted to on full scholarship. And like, I just can't tell you how quickly that seemed to happen. Now, you know, I was ranked number one in the world. So, but that would never have mattered at all had that happened if I had just been a couple years older. So the deal is, right, we don't just want to give people who are number one in the world. We want, you know, the same, you know, tens of thousands that the boys have to have those opportunities for the girls. It's not just about being the best. When Brown University, when that case happened, and the court held equal is equal, and they've sort of continued to do that over time, I thought as a lawyer that I wasn't going to be able to do Title IX work because I just thought the whole thing was going to be over. As opposed to like employment discrimination, or when it comes to, let's say, you know, employment or sexual harassment, it's so much harder to prove. In athletics, it is so, because you have formal sex segregation. So women and girls are entitled to whatever you're giving men and boys. So it's really easy to measure. We have a website, Champion Women does, called title9schools.com, and it'll tell you both high school and college what every school in the country, how they're doing. So we took that project of every school in the country, and then we wanted to take it a step further, and we wanted to file these Title IX complaints, and we gave ample evidence for all the three prongs of, like, what is the gap if there was proportionality? What is the gap? Number two is there this history of continuous improvement there is a website called the EADA, the Equity in Athletics Disclosure Act. But if you go onto your, if you want to look at it, you can just type in EADA and it'll show you every school in higher ed, including junior colleges, et cetera, and how it is that they're doing. You kind of have to be a lawyer to be able to interpret those numbers. And that's why we created our website, because we wanted to make it crystal clear for everybody. Then we took, we downloaded all that data and we did the mathematical formulas to it. We also took all that data historically and we were able to plot it on a graph line. So right now it's 19 years of data that says whether or not a school has this continuous history. And then for the issue of are they meeting the interests and abilities of the student athletes, we looked at recruiting budgets, which, oh my gosh, I mean, they're literally 10 to 20% of their total recruiting budget. I mean, I would say the gap in recruiting is bigger than like the participation or the scholarship gap. I think when you talk to any athlete who has competed in high school and college, any athlete, they can tell you how they're not getting treated the same way that the boys and men are. And that is a terrible message, not just for the girls and their families, but it's a really bad message for boys and men as well, to be getting this idea that they should get more, that they should get treated better. So if you go onto our website, Title IX Schools, you can see all 101 complaints. The Department of Ed has come back to us several times and wanted more information. We've been providing that information. And it's going to be really interesting to see what happens as a result of these complaints. They're very, very detailed. They're not sort of higher level, like in theory, there could be discriminating. But you know, we don't depend on 18 to 22 year olds in college to be able to file these complaints, right? You've got to have somebody like Alisa to bring the case against Brown University. I think it's unreasonable to expect 18 to 22 year olds to sue their school. Most of them love their school. I mean, I certainly, I'm crazy. I went to Duke University, crazy in love with the school. So I honestly, I'm shocked that we're still, that we're not there. And that since 2010, that the gap between men's and women is growing. Nobody's looking at it. There's no oversight. There's no other than us, Champion Women. I mean, who else is sort of looking at all those metrics?
Yes, Bonnie, you wanted to respond?
Well, I wanted to add that at this point, regrettably, a lot of schools, you know, have been built and are now landlocked. So in terms of that prong, you know, are you showing that you are expanding and gradually, you know, adding women's sports till it's equivalent to what men have, or are you meeting the interest? Some schools now will say, we'd love to, but we cannot expand. We are in the city, or we're unable to add to our campus. That's an excuse you'll hear. And
Wait, Bonnie, if I can interrupt just a second, that may be an excuse, but it's not a legal defense. You cannot go to court and say, we don't have enough money, because right. If that was the case, I mean, in the Brown University case, the court held if lack of funds was a justifiable reason for giving women less, Congress wouldn't have gone to all the trouble of passing Title IX.
Right. So, I am a finance professor now, and they saved, as I said before, $60,000, and the lawsuit cost them over $3 million. So that is not a good return on investment.
It's simply the point that I'm making is when we're talking about, you know, 17 to 22 year olds, my students are often unfamiliar with, let's say, architectural history, which is very much part of Title IX. Georgetown famously had to turn a broom closet into a woman's bathroom because its science building only had bathrooms for men. There was never any expectation that women would A, attend Georgetown, B, major in STEM. So we're still fixing facilities to create an atmosphere that's welcoming to women in academia. In terms of sports, one school where I taught for a long time, George Washington, famously bought out a closed junior college, Mount Vernon, and then automatically had a whole lot of land so they could add women's soccer, women's softball, and women's lacrosse. And that is not everybody's opportunity, but that was certainly an option of how do you find, you know, more land, how do you expand? But you also get this tension between men and women where, let's say, guys who've been playing, you know, baseball since they were five, expressing resentment that women are now getting a regulation softball, you know, field where they've been waiting forever to get a baseball field built. And so one of the things that has to be avoided is athletic departments or university budget people building in a resentment between the men and women in terms of what gets cut and who gets priority. And then you get many very vocal and active conservative moms and organizations saying, you see, Title IX is just reverse discrimination. It's a quota law. And that's a whole other story. But that happens when you have successful men's teams made to feel that they are the sacrificial lambs for women's equality. And we have to keep emphasizing it's not a zero-sum game. The daughters and sons are both important. Everyone moves forward. The daughters have been behind through strategic intention for a really long time.
And Nancy, you had a response as well.
All of these, like what Bonnie was saying, so schools have an interest in blaming women instead of saying it's our own fault. We've had 50 years to figure out how to provide equality for boys and girls and men and women, and we haven't done it. It's so much easier to blame girls and women. You know, I always say I've got a son, I've got twin daughters. I would never tell my son, oh, you can't do XYZ. You can't go on this academic trip because your sisters. It's all because of your sisters, right? I mean, just what a terrible messaging that is. And as I said, most schools, they are trying, like Stanford University, we just saw this a couple years ago, they tried to just shrink their athletic department. So a lot of schools are trying to shrink their athletic department. The athletic director is perfectly happy just having the minimum number of teams. At the University of Texas, they have, it's less than 1% of the student body is playing sports. Less than 1%. So, like, are there girls interested and able to do more? They're on our list. They're denying girls and women millions of dollars in college scholarships. But so much of this, it relates to power and how, you know, who gets to say whether or not that the school's going to spend more on women generally. And it's terrible that it takes a federal judge to make a school do it. But unfortunately, like my experience is that when there's litigation, you first of all, you shouldn't need litigation. As I said, this is really easy to measure. Everybody should know, like, you know, how many opportunities are, right? And you want to count athletes, not numbers of teams. And then, you know, are they getting treated the same way? Are they, do they, you know, same scholarship dollars? But so you've got to make that information that's easily accessible, right? But it's just, it pains me that it takes a federal judge to make a school do what they should have been doing for the last literally 30 years. When Cohen versus Brown University came out, it was a strong enough signal that I thought I wasn't going to be able to do my legal career was not going to be based on Title IX because I thought it was going to be done. So I was like, better figure out something else to do here.
Your statements on power, we got about 5 minutes left, but I want to make sure to ask this, and I'll direct it first towards Bonnie. I'm at the University of Southern California, and one of the most interesting is for the first time in the history of the athletic department, they have a woman as the athletic director. They hired Jen Cohen as the athletic director. And a number of schools are, there are more women, though significantly underrepresented, obviously, in that position, but there are more women. So Bonnie, the question is, how much as a way to address this is, you know, as a policy, just the power in athletic departments who presumably would be more interested in.
Yeah, of course, that would be terrific. And the reason there's been a lag is in part because of Title IX. Title IX made it possible for men to earn a living coaching women. And many universities collapsed the old women's division into the men's and just let go all of the women leaders, coaches, athletic directors, who, while segregated, at least had some control over their own area. Ended up with male control of female talent, very similar to what happened with Black baseball in the 40s and 50s. When Jackie Robinson goes into the majors, we move Black talent into white control and so forth. The big question now is not simply more women athletic directors making a difference, but can women coach men's teams and officiate at men's events? And we tend to see more women doing sideline commentary or sports journalism and excellent sports writing, but not so much officiating men's games or being the primary coach of men's teams. And when that evens out, that's a goal I hope to see attained.
I want to add one more thing. So we're talking about college sports, but when we look at sports more generally, it's a business. And studies have shown that when you have more diverse, inclusive teams, and you have women in leadership roles along with men, right? We don't want to just flip it and have a different pie that we're eating, right? When we have diverse, inclusive teams, we're more profitable, we're more innovative, we have less risk within our organizations, and we have more retention within the overall organization as well. So there are many benefits. And so the why we're talking about all of this right now, why it's so important for women to have these opportunities to play sports when they're qualified and able, is because these sports teach women to be better leaders, teach women to be better managers, teach women to be better coworkers. We know how to fail. We know how to lead. We know how to work in a team. We know how to collaborate. And those are all the skills that make incredible CEOs, heads of surgery, political activists, political leaders. That's why we need women to play sports.
And Nancy, we have about 90 seconds left. I want to give you the last word on this question.
As I said earlier, this is an excellent use of our tax dollars when you're talking about, you know, basic sports. When you're talking about, there's only, actually Bonnie and Lisa probably know a little better, and there's only like, you know, 40 or 50 programs that are revenue positive. The vast majority, there are 2000 schools in the EADA database. And right, so you're looking at less than 0.5% of all the schools that are actually make money. But we have this crazy economic incentives to this effort to try to recruit. There's no way that the NFL and the NBA, et cetera, would have a system that less than 1% of them would be revenue positive. They're all revenue positive. Not so with college sports, and not so with high school sports. And so we need to figure out to get athletics back to what is its original purpose, which is to, as Lisa and Bonnie have both beautifully articulated, it is to make better kids. It's the things that they learn in sports that help them to be able, right? So this other issue of the very elite, a tiny, tiny percentage that can actually make money it's not that it makes money, it's that it's revenue positive, is kind of a distraction. it should, if it was true that making lots of money was good for women, or was that it helped women, then you would see those Division I schools would be much closer to compliance with Title IX and giving women equality. That's not the case. So there's another factor other than money as to why schools are why women are being discriminated against. And we need to focus on that.
Absolutely. And I think the Title IX conversation raises issues about gender equity, about gender opportunity, about gender equality, the opportunities that sports provides. What exactly is the proper role of athletic programs within universities, but most importantly, the importance not just of Congress passing legislation, but lots of incredibly dedicated activists on an ongoing political campaign, ongoing political drama as this unfolds. And I think it's important to take a step to say Title IX has accomplished a great deal, and there's still a great deal yet to be done. We've been talking about Title IX, women's athletics, women's equity at the university level. And our panel today has been Lisa Kaplowitz, Associate Professor of Professional Practice in the Finance and Economics Department at Rutgers Business School. She's the co-founder and executive director of the Rutgers Center for Women in Business and the author of the article Title IX Increased Opportunities for Women Athletes, But There's Still Work to Do, and Thought Leadership, How Men Can Advance Gender Equity at Work. Bonnie Morris is a lecturer in the Department of History at the University of California, Berkeley. She's the author of The Feminist Revolution, Women's History for Beginners, and What's the Score? 25 Years of Teaching Women's Sports History. And Nancy Hogshead Maker, she's on the faculty at Rutgers New Brunswick Global Business and Sports MS Program, the CEO and founder of Champion Women. She also won 3 gold medals and 1 silver medal at the 1984 Olympics. She's the co-author with Andrew Zimbalist of Equal Play, Title IX, and Social Change, and the author of Pregnant and Parenting Student Athletes, Resources, and Model Policies. Thank you all very, very much for your time, for your expertise, and your passion and commitment to this issue. Thank you.
And that's it for today's program. Thank you for listening. The Scholar Circle is hosted by Doug Becker. Its managing producer is Ankina Agassian. Mahika Chechi is our assistant producer. Sed Dongre is our webmaster and assistant producer. Our archives are at scholarcircle.org, and our podcasts are on Apple and Google Podcasts and iTunes. Please follow us on @ScholarCircle or me @Armudian and join our Facebook page. I'm the founder, anchor, and occasional host, Maria Armudian.